Chapter 18. Kit had spent the morning picking dewberries all up and down the farm road that led to the ranch house. She picked and picked until she had filled a kitchen-sized garbage bag with berries and brought it home to Eleanor for canning. Eleanor had a giant pot of water on the boil, and on every flat surface were dozens of mason jars drying on towels.
"Sweet Lord, that's a lot of fruit," her aunt said,
and peered inside the bag Kit was holding open for her.
"I'm gonna need some more jars."
She rummaged around the little makeshift desk she had set up on the counter nearest to the telephone and started sketching equations.
"Let's see. That's a 13-gallon bag, and the jars hold a pint each."
"Is it too much?" Kit asked, suddenly worried she had messed up.
"I could eat what you don't can, or..."
"No,"
Eleanor said. She flapped her hands as if to tamp down any misunderstanding.
"It's marvelous! An embarrassment of riches! I'm just tickled! It's just I've never gotten more than a couple gallons! How far down did you go?"
"Oh, I don't know. Nearly up to the bridge."
"Up to the bridge? That's a half a mile of picking!"
She shook her head.
"You're a little worker bee, aren't you?"
Kit was almost embarrassed by the praise and by how much she liked hearing she had done good. Her contentment was interrupted by a knock and a shrill but musical voice.
"Yoo-hoo!"
Kit opened the door to see Sugar Fay and another woman looking like they were dressed up for a party. Sugar was wearing high-heeled boots and stylish dark jeans that cinched her waist and flared a little where her stomach stressed the zipper. Her slip of a top was the color and texture of pearl. Kit wondered how many people she had to pay to keep something like that clean. The woman beside her looked country next to her cosmopolitan friend, but not for lack of trying. She wore a floppy brown sun hat over her bouffant and a knee-length mustard vest with matching pants that made her look even shorter than she was.
"Howdy, Kit. Hey, Eleanor, how do?"
Sugar called out.
"I'm still here," said Eleanor dryly. "That's good enough for me."
"Praise Jesus," said Sugar. "Kit, this is Beulah Baker."
Beulah waved a little wave from the wrist up, jangling her charm bracelet.
"Nice to meet you,"
Beulah said. Her voice was high, like her vocal cords hadn't grown up with the rest of her, and there was a sour twist to her smile. There must have been a can of hairspray between the two of them, and the smell reminded Kit of red.
"Listen," Sugar said. "Beulah and me were going to hang out at my house. Maybe go swimming or do makeup. Nothing fancy, just us girls. I thought you might like to join."
Kit couldn't think of anything at that moment that was less appealing to her. It was friendly of them to have come by, but she figured they were just being nice. That, or Eleanor had put them up to it.
"That's okay," she said,
and gestured toward the canning operation in the kitchen. "I have a bunch of work to do." Sugar and Beulah glanced at each other.
"Eleanor,"
Sugar called through the doorway,
"you ever let this girl out of the house?"
"I try," Eleanor said, drying her hands on her apron. "She's a hopeless homebody like me."
Beulah turned to Sugar and whispered, not very quietly,
"See? I told you she wasn't interested."
"Shoosh," Sugar snapped, then turned a kinder face to Kit.
"Now, listen, I won't take no for an answer. You can't just show up to a bored little town looking all exotic and mysterious and not let us size you up. I won't have it."
She let out a high-pitched tinkle of laughter. Kit kind of respected her honesty, though she sure didn't like the idea of being a subject of conversation.
"Get out of here, girl,"
Eleanor said, taking off her apron. She hung it on a nail and crossed over to Kit.
Everyone needs a friend, even you.
Kit was trapped between the women at the door and Eleanor.
But what about the jars? She asked hopefully. Don't you need me to pick up some more?
Eleanor put up a hand.
That's all right. I'll make do just fine. You go be young, she said, smiling. Come on, Kit, Sugar said, and jangled her keys. Jump in my car. We'll ride together.
Kit was reluctant to go party with strangers. She flashed Eleanor a look that said, save me. But her aunt did not seem to get the message. They all appeared to be waiting for her answer.
Okay, Kit finally said, but I'll drive myself.
Sugar clapped her hands together like a kid at a circus.
Hot dog! There we go! Keys are on the hook,
Eleanor said, and handed her a rolled up $5 bill from her purse.
Here's a little cash, she said with a gleeful spark, in case you go out honky-tonkin'.
Kit took the money and said thank you. Then she leaned in and whispered to her aunt, are you sure you don't need me here? But Eleanor turned her toward the door and gave her a gentle push. Kit took the brown and white pickup and followed Sugar's jacked-up Bronco over the bumpy farm roads until they hit the nice, smooth highway that led to the bigger ranches. Sugar signaled the turn, and Kit followed her down a short gravel road lined with poplars and around a circular drive. They parked in front of her house, new construction made to look like a lodge with big, barky logs. Inside, it was king size with custom everything, a trophy of a home. There was a menagerie of game on the walls and a collection of firearms on display as if to offer proof of who had shot those animals. The living room was three full-size sofas arranged around a curly buffalo pelt rug. It was at once ostentatious and welcoming, intimidating and comfortable. She couldn't help but want to kick off her boots and stretch out on the leather sofa that was draped in throw blankets, large and plush. Kit couldn't fathom how someone went about paying for a place like this. A tow-headed child with Sugar's angelic face toddled down the hall toward his mother.
Hi, baby,
she squealed, so loud Kit could feel her inner ears pulse.
Oh, come to mama.
The little boy tripped forward into her arms. She held him close and gave him a little squeeze.
Do you want to hold Nestor, Kit?
Sugar said, eyeing the bump of Kit's stomach. Nestor was pudgy and cute and had a sticky brown mess around his mouth, but Kit felt no warmth for the boy. She held him out straight-armed, his legs kicking around. She was shocked at how dense and heavy he was for such a small child. The boy arched his back and whined.
I swear to God, Sugar said, laughing in disbelief. I never saw a Mexican that wasn't born knowing how to take care of children.
Kit passed Nestor back to Sugar, irritated by the slight. Sugar took a lolly out of her purse, unwrapped it, and let Nestor suckle it while she stroked his hair.
Yeah, Beulah chimed in. Haven't you ever been around babies? Didn't you grow up with a million brothers and sisters and cousins and stuff?
She poured cold white wine into glasses. I'm not Mexican, Kit said. Of course, she could have been, but couldn't say for sure where her father came from. She didn't see the point in claiming that she was, or being the subject of Sugar's opinion about how Mexican or not Kit measured up to be. Sugar rolled her eyes, frustrated at having to clarify.
Salvadorian, Guatemalan, you know what I mean.
Kit stared at her, wishing she could summon Manny's charms. He'd take charge of the conversation without offending, distract with a flattering question and a wink. Sugar went on.
Now don't give me that look. I mean that in the best way. I learned everything I know about babies from our live-in. I swear, when Robbie 2 was born, I didn't know which hole to feed and which one to wipe. She is a goddamn hero, that woman. Glory, glow day.
Sugar said with an accent meant to sound like Spanish. She kept looking in the direction she expected Gloria to come from until a woman in her 50s did, in fact, appear in the hallway. An older boy, about 4 years old, with his hands in the back pocket of her jeans.
Mande,
she said. She looked tired and scolded the boy lightly in Spanish.
Gloria, could you tomar el bebé? We're gonna have some grown-up time.
Sure thing,
Gloria said in a crisp American accent that suggested she'd been in the States a long time, if not all her life. Kit thought it sounded a touch defiant, like she wouldn't be put in her place. Nestor, upon seeing Gloria, pushed himself off of Sugar and toddled happily into his nanny's arms.
I think she loves them as much as she loves her own kids, Sugar said. Sometimes I think they love her more than me.
I know they love her more than you,
Beulah said. She cocked her head and gave a funny look like she was thinking something over.
So now, Kit, if you're not a Mexican, what?
Beulah started to ask, what are you? A question Kit had heard enough times to know when it was coming. But Beulah seemed to stop herself and took a vaguer angle.
What's your deal?
Kit waited for her to clarify.
Like, who's your parents and whatnot?
Kit still was not sure how to answer this. She let the question hang, awkward as a fart.
Like, well, Eleanor says your mama was her niece, so what was your daddy?
Kit flushed. Why were they so obsessed with knowing what she was? It was as if they needed to know her race and country of origin so they could calibrate their opinion of her. The ache of missing her mother was familiar, but it stung in a different way to think of her father, especially here, in the company of these prying women. There was nothing, no trace of him to build on. He could be anyone, a king, a criminal, a poet, a nobody. How had he and her mother met? Had he singled her out in a crowded bar? Maybe her mother had made the first move, slipped her number between his fingers at a concert. Maybe they had one wild night together before parting ways. It must have been a casual encounter, but sometimes she let herself think she was born of love. I didn't have parents, Kit said. Sugar slapped her hand to her heart and drew an audible breath.
Oh, my word! An orphan? That's the saddest thing I've ever heard.
It was fine. I never knew them, so.
Did you grow up in an orphanage?
Beulah asked.
What was it like? Were they cruel to you?
Kit was beginning to buckle under the inquiry and the memories it stirred. The dictionary splitting her cheek, the surprise whippings, the taunts, being left in the car while a foster parent ran errands, no matter how hot it was outside, how she'd roll down the window and fight with herself the whole time about which was more trouble, staying or leaving. Loud, long nights in the group home in between placements. Kids who sleepwalked and had night terrors. Criers and fighters. And the one boy who talked incessantly to silence the voices in his head. All the nights she had gone to bed wishing she wouldn't wake up in the morning. The constant feeling that she was not wanted. That her very existence was a bother. She had never told anyone about growing up in foster care, and she wasn't about to start with these biddies.
No, nothing like that, Kit said. You wouldn't think it, but I had a pretty normal childhood.
The two women exchanged a look, like they knew she was holding out.
If you never knew your folks,
Beulah asked pointedly,
how was it then that you got hooked up with Eleanor?
Kit tightened the muscles between her shoulders. The question sounded like a trap. She knew from running around with Manny that you never told a lie if you didn't have to. My social worker told me about her, Kit said plainly. So, when I was old enough, I came looking.
You just left everything?
Sugar said, gaping a little to show she needed to be convinced.
Your foster family and your life and came here to Pecan Hollow?
Beulah scowled at her.
What?
Sugar said.
It's not like it's a destination.
I'd never had family before. Not for real, Kit said. And the truth of it moved her to the edge of tears. She muscled back the emotion, determined not to lose it here. Sugar's hand went back to her heart, and Beulah puckered her lips into a pout.
Hey,
Beulah said and sniffed.
Are we gonna do makeup or what? I got my niece watching the kids tonight, and she is dumber than a cow. I give her till 7 p.m. before I have to come home to fix whatever she screwed up tonight. You are bad, Beulah. I know, I shouldn't. All right, Sugar said. Let's party.
She slid a thin pink suitcase with a gold clasp out from under the coffee table and opened it up for them. Inside were dozens of peach-colored bottles, compacts, and pencils, all labeled in cursive. Eyeshadows, powders, lipsticks, creams. It smelled like vanilla and was so brazenly girlish, Kit began to sweat.
Oh, this is like candy to me, Beulah said. I'll have one of everything.
She reached out to touch the lipsticks, but Sugar swatted her hand away.
Don't touch the merchandise unless you really plan to buy it. Any product that gets damaged or used comes out of my pocket. Here, baby, she said, taking Beulah by the chin. I'ma do your colors. Actually, Sugar, why don't you let Kit go first? I would love to see what you would do with her. She's got so much potential.
Sugar clapped her hands together.
You don't mind, do you, Kit? A little makeover? I won't make you buy anything. It's just...
She paused to choose her words, pressing her lips together, looking pained.
I don't know. I'm just dying to pretty you up. Will you let me? Please.
This was no place for her. All of it was wrong. Ever since she got to Pecan Hollow, she'd been lying and covering up, pretending to smile, faking a laugh, playing by rules she didn't understand. Kit's throat burned with anger toward the two women. On the surface, they were being friendly, but she knew they had brought her here to take her down a peg. She might be a freak and a criminal, but she was nobody's clown. At least she had her own wheels. Kit got up and crossed the buffalo pelt without a word and let herself out the door. Chapter 19. By mid-October, the season had changed almost overnight from constant unbearable heat to a pleasant cool, with occasional rains that scrubbed and crisped the air. At about 6 months pregnant, Kit was changing too. Her wooden face softened, her breasts filled out even more, and the roundness of her belly where the baby was now beginning to kick and squirm was impossible to conceal. As Eleanor had warned, people in town started to talk. At first, there were the long stares from the women in line at the store, or the cogers playing cards with palsied hands in front of the diner. She could feel them assessing and theorizing. When she had been so accustomed to invisibility, being the subject of scrutiny embarrassed her, made her feel like she was living someone else's life. Sugar Fay, having recently announced her own pregnancy, came by regularly with gifts of food and women's magazines and fresh gossip. Despite Kit's hasty exit from the makeup party, Sugar was determined to stay friends. Kit tolerated her presence as an unavoidable fact of life. She thanked Sugar for the gifts, but she did not stick around for the company. Eleanor sprang to action with the preparations for the baby. She went to town and raised eyebrows with the volume of groceries she bought. She cooked for hours, freezing casseroles, roasting chickens in threes, and using the bones for stock that she had Kit drink like tea. Collards and turnips, black-eyed peas, Virginia ham with biscuits, sticky pecan pie on Sundays. She knew just what to do for Kit's aches and pains, for food aversions and reflux and cramps. One chilly Saturday, Kit went to fetch the mail and check the newspaper. At the little post office in town, she opened a small locked box and found the day's mail, a Sears catalog, some bills, and a Reader's Digest. Then she crossed the old railroad track that cut through town to the diner with its curved glass facade and shark fin awning. There were two newspaper vending machines out front, one for the Houston Chronicle, its plastic window yellowed and cloudy, stacked to the brim. The smaller machine next to it, which held the Weekly Hauler, was empty. Kit had learned from Eleanor that the Weekly Hauler was basically a circular with ads from local businesses and a forum where people posted birth announcements, death announcements, garage sales, rodeos, lost animals, and even, from time to time, love letters. People weren't so concerned about national or international news. Even the big city news from Houston was a little too fast-paced and scintillating. The good stuff was homegrown. Everyone got the hauler. She pushed her dime through the slot and pulled out the Houston Chronicle, which was triple the size of the local rag. She flipped to the crime section, something she had done every couple of weeks, hoping and dreading she would find news of Manny. The front page was covered with examples of people acting badly. A man shot in a dispute between his teenage daughters. A 6-year-old drowned in the Buffalo Bayou by her stepfather. A woman missing 7 years found stuffed in a basement freezer. Heinous crimes she could not imagine committing. Whatever wrong she had done, it was nothing by comparison. But she thought, that's exactly the kind of justification Manny would come up with. She'd heard a million of them over the years.
They're lucky we only robbed them. Nobody got hurt. It's just money, kitty cat. Government steals people's money every damn day. Not my fault I figured out an easy way to get rich. Only difference between me and everybody else is I'm willing to take the risk.
She already felt bad about what she'd done. But now that she was straight, she was just as ashamed of how she had let herself believe that their version of stealing wasn't wrong. Then, as if he had heard her thoughts, his face appeared on the next page. There was Manny, in cuffs, looking directly into the camera, being escorted down a stairwell. The photo was small, maybe 2 inches by 3, next to a brief article below the fold, but there was no mistaking him. Even in black and white, she could see the blue in his eyes. Just above it, a headline in small font, "One of Texaco Twosome Convicted." Her legs weakened. Kit spread the Houston Chronicle over the flat top of the vending machine and read the article. It was a small piece, perhaps an update on others written before. Manuel Romero, self-described mastermind of the Texaco Twosome robbery duo, was convicted on all counts, including robbery and unlawful restraint, following his July 4 arrest. He had held a woman at gunpoint while robbing her barbecue stand, the famed Stoker's Barbecue, then took her, briefly, as hostage. Her husband and several customers disarmed and restrained him while his accomplice fled the scene. The arrest follows a string of robberies, mainly at filling stations in remote areas. Mr. Romero's signature style gained some notoriety as Austin County Police coined the term Texaco Twosome to drum up interest in the case. Police are still searching for his female partner, though an accurate description eludes them. One witness stated she had short, buzzed hair and a dark complexion. Another, the owner's daughter, insisted her hair was long. Mr. Romero has declined to provide information on her appearance or whereabouts, stating only that she was the love of his life. Kit's eyes stung and her face felt hot. This was her first glimpse of what had happened after she drove away, and though she'd wondered what had become of Manny these last 3.5 months, this dose of information left her wildly confused. On the one hand, she was relieved to know he would be in prison. There had always been the chance that he was hunting her down. The part of her that still loved him was moved, even remorseful, to see that he didn't begrudge her. That even though she had bailed on him, he would not betray her. But when she reread the article, she detected something almost theatrical about his quote, like he had known she would be reading it. How was she supposed to take this? Manny was rarely straightforward and sincere. Did he think she would be in his debt? Just then, Beulah Baker passed by, following her husband, who was carrying a stack of packages. Kit slapped the paper shut, then nodded at them, tense and barely breathing, afraid she'd been caught.
"Didn't mean to give you a fright,"
Beulah said with a child's laugh. Kit tried to wave her on, pleasantly enough, but without any invitation to stay and chat. They made it to their Wagoneer without stopping, and her husband unloaded the packages. Beulah waved again as she climbed up into the car and called out,
"You have a blessed day now!"
Once they were good and gone, Kit looked around as if she were being watched. She knew the police would be looking for her, but the witness description of her buzz cut made her furious. Manny had cut her hair to throw people off the scent, but it had only made her more recognizable. Everyone had seen her roll into town, the freak newcomer with no hair. Someone would only have to read the article and give it a moment's thought. They were already so goddamn suspicious of her, it wouldn't take much imagination. She pumped another dime in the slot, took the whole stack of papers, including the one in the window, and rushed back to Eleanor's truck. Kit waited until Eleanor was asleep that night before rolling the grill from the shed out to the driveway. She removed the green lid and dumped in the stack of newspapers. Then she struck a match, threw it on the pile, and watched the papers burn. Kit knew she owed her aunt the truth. It didn't feel right to be lying to her while living under her roof, eating her food, enjoying her company. This was supposed to be a fresh start, and she didn't see a way to move forward without coming clean to Eleanor. And she couldn't stand the idea of her aunt finding out on her own. On the other hand, she was about 3 months away from having this baby. If Eleanor had a crisis of conscience and turned her in, her baby might be born in prison, or worse, taken from her. She also didn't want to put Eleanor in the position of knowingly harboring a criminal. If anything happened to her aunt because of Kit's mistakes, she would never forgive herself. Maybe she should leave the state. Her hair had grown over an inch since the robbery at Stoker's, and she was pregnant. No one would recognize her if she started over someplace new. But it was too late to leave. She needed Eleanor. The baby needed her. Making sure her baby had a good home was more important than having a clean conscience. She could live with the guilt. She would have to. Someday, she could come out and tell Eleanor that she had stolen honest people's money, that she'd been a party to terror. But not today. So Kit carried the secret like a promise. She would tell Eleanor when she knew her baby would be safe. In the meantime, she worked overtime to be helpful to Eleanor. She dug trenches for a little irrigation system around the thirsty hydrangeas, welded new latches on the front gate, and when they finally got a string of sunny days after several days of rain, Kit climbed up on top of the house to mend the roof.
"You're mad! You'll kill yourself and that baby, too!"
Eleanor scolded her.
"I can't watch this. I'm going inside."
Kit laughed as she scaled the ladder easily and seated herself on the roof.
"Don't worry, I'll be careful,"
she yelled after her aunt. Perched up high, going where she shouldn't, felt as natural as sitting in a lawn chair. She had often pried open the attic window at the Moshers and looked at the stars, the hazy lights of Houston to the east, and to the west, darkness. Within minutes, Eleanor was back outside again, a sloshing pitcher of iced tea in one hand, and in the other, a telephone, the tail of its cord winding up the steps and in the front door.
"I decided I should be here ready to call 911 in case you fall."
"Look, if the roof caves in on us from the rain, we won't be any better off. Anyway, I feel good. I'm pregnant, not crippled." Kit began pulling nails with the claw of her hammer and scraping the old, brittle scales to the ground.
"I'm just glad I planted that boxwood around the house," Eleanor said. "It'll break your fall."
They were quiet for a bit while Kit pried up shingles and tossed them aside. She heard Eleanor clear her throat and look down at her aunt, who was holding a chicken in her lap and stroking its neck. Kit stopped scraping and caught her breath.
"All right," Eleanor said, sounding stern. "I have something to say. I've been thinking about it a lot. I get the feeling that you don't let much in and you don't let much out. But you're going to have a little one soon, and you've got to start things off on the right foot. If you have something to tell me, then tell me. And if you want to know something, well, damn it, you gotta ask me. I don't know how long I have to wait before we have an honest conversation here."
Kit had so far successfully avoided discussing anything from her past in detail. She had said that she left a dead-end relationship in search of real family, that her time in foster care had been shitty and she didn't want to talk about it. She had been expecting and dreading the day when her aunt would press her to say more because she did not think she could bring herself to lie to Eleanor. Why would she want to bring such ugliness into this new life? Surely it was best to keep facing forward. She could not change the past, but she could protect today. And Manny. There was no honest explanation she was willing to share. She searched for something that might satisfy Eleanor's curiosity.
"You can tell me," Eleanor said. "I've lived a long time. You can't scare me. Whatever it is, just let her rip."
"I don't know," Kit said. "A lot of it is fuzzy in my memory. I don't like to go back there if I can help it." Eleanor stopped stroking the hen and was very still, listening. "I remember being hungry all the time. Even when there was food enough, I was hungry. Bottomless. It was the thing that got me up in the morning. What am I gonna eat today?" She kept her eyes on the shingles. It helped to work while she talked. Splitting her attention cut the pain in two. She didn't look at her aunt. Didn't think she could keep talking if she saw her face.
"Did you have friends? Anyone you could turn to?"
Eleanor asked, hopeful. Kit thought about it. She had had Miss Rhonda and Red, the only person from her old life who knew she'd gone to Pecan Hollow. temporary stand-in mothers, maybe. And of course, there was Manny. But she could not call him a friend as she understood the word. She shook her head.
I wasn't very nice to people, Kit said. They had no reason to like me.
It wears on you, being unwanted over and over. First my mother, then the social workers always trying to get me off their hands. Then as soon as I was placed, it was like the foster parents were just counting down the days. So I started to act like I didn't care if I stayed or went. And maybe I even did things that would get me sent back to the group home, just to prove how much I didn't care. To prove I knew what I was.
Knew what you were?
Trash, Kit said, something pooling in her chest. A great sadness at the truth of it. Eleanor shook her head vigorously.
You are no such thing. Just because people did wrong by you doesn't mean you're worthless. You are a gift. To me, you are.
Kit wanted to believe her. Eleanor was tearful and seemed sincere. But when Kit was all swirled up inside like this, it was impossible to take in the good. She stretched her head to the side, her neck so tight she thought the tendons might snap. Eleanor covered her mouth and widened her eyes, as if considering something for the first time.
Did they beat you, dear?
Kit laughed darkly.
Well, sure, she said, surprised at her aunt's innocence. That was the easy part.
Eleanor gasped and looked over her shoulder at nothing. When she turned her face up at Kit, her features were pinched together.
I wish you wouldn't make light. I couldn't feel more awful about this. I just couldn't.
Kit felt bitter. She didn't pity Eleanor right now. She resented her.
You know, I could tell you everything and you wouldn't sleep for a week knowing what I've seen and who looked after me. I'm making light of it because it's too ugly to just talk about. Maybe you're right. And I should be shooting straight with you. But I can't fill you in on years of nothing good over a glass of iced tea. It hurts me to talk about it. I don't want to. I start with one story and the whole mess slides out of me.
Eleanor stomped her foot, sending the hen fluttering off her lap.
For God's sakes, would you come down off that roof? You're too far away. I can't talk to you like this.
Kit was startled by her anger and said nothing. Eleanor took a breath and let it out.
Listen, I told you I can take it. Whatever it is, you can tell me. But I can respect your need for privacy. If you think it would be helpful to you, I hope you'll come and tell me in your own time.
She emptied her pockets of chicken scratch and turned them inside out, shaking out the dust. She walked to the front door, head hung low, pensive. Then she stopped and turned up toward Kit.
You know, that stuff will not go away. It will make you sickly and turn to rot. If not me, somebody. You have got to tell somebody.
Both women worked off the stress of their conversation in their own realms. Kit patched the roof until dusk. Eleanor holed up in the kitchen and cooked, and from the smells that wafted up from the open windows, Kit guessed they were having pork chops, grits, and greens, a meal Eleanor knew she loved. She didn't want to be cross with her aunt. If only these things came easy to her, sharing and close conversation. She swatted a late-season mosquito on her neck and wiped it on her shirt. She wasn't ready to detail the cruelties she had suffered, and she couldn't imagine feeling otherwise. Eleanor, she hoped, would forgive her that. She gathered the sandy, rubbery shards of roof and wheeled them to the pickup to dump in the morning. She washed her face and hands at the spigot on the side of the house and tidied the short strands of her hair, something she had begun to do as a small gesture of respect to her aunt, and went inside for dinner. Chapter 20. Kit awoke one morning in January, disturbed by the silence. The creaks underfoot echoed as she pressed cautiously down the stairs. When she saw that the kitchen, which had always been lit and full of sounds and smells by 6 a.m., was cold and empty, she readied herself for nothing good. As she turned into the living room, she saw Eleanor slumped unnaturally into the wing of her high-backed chair with the weekly holler spread across her lap like a caftan. Kit cried out, turned, and gagged on an odor, sharp and musty. "No, no, no," she said, as if she could undo what she was seeing. She knelt and held Eleanor's frigid hand and stroked it, pressed it between her own, which were warm from sleep and rough as bark. But this cold would not lift. Alone again, she thought with a familiar pang and cried into Eleanor's hand. "Nothing good can last. Nothing good belongs to me." She was ashamed of the selfishness of these thoughts here next to Eleanor, who had been so decent to her. "It's not fair," she thought. Eleanor would never get a chance to see the baby. Her aunt had so looked forward to the birth, had filled the drawers of the little chest with soft gowns, socks and hats, diapers, and plush animals she had gone all the way to Houston to buy. It would have been a great gift to have help raising her child, but the thing that she mourned was the way it felt to be around her aunt. Eleanor had paid such close attention, had always known when to move in and when to leave a wide perimeter. Wrapped up in the security of her aunt's home and good care, Kit had let down her guard. And now she was back where she had started. The numbness began to bloom in her middle, pulsing outward, promising to shield her from the pain, so old and deep it was a part of her. Alone, 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 wretched and broken and all alone. Then, as if in reply, she felt a nudge against her bottom rib. "Not for long," it seemed to say. Pregnant as she was, it took Kit 10 minutes to get Eleanor up the stairs. She squatted with her back to her aunt and held her wrists in front of her neck, then stood up. Eleanor's body moved strangely, unnaturally loose in places, stiff in others. She took each step deliberately, managing the balance between the load on her front and the one on her back, until she reached the landing. She shuffled down the hall, laid her aunt gently on the bed, sponged and dried her, and dressed her in a coral knit suit. Though Kit had never worn pantyhose herself, she knew Eleanor never went anywhere without them. After struggling to stuff her aunt's rigid legs into a gauzy pair of beige stockings, she finally found a pair of knee highs balled up in the back of the drawer and snaked them on, making sure the snags were facing down. There was a little makeup still on Eleanor's soft, powdered face, the shadows of her eyebrows, peach liner marking the vague edges of her lips. With a damp rag, Kit dabbed away the colors from hairline to collarbone and thought her aunt looked beautiful just so. She attempted to wrap a bun on top of her head, but it wouldn't hold, so she brushed the rusty gray hair smooth over her aunt's shoulders. When she was satisfied that Eleanor would be happy enough with how she looked, Kit lay down next to her aunt and rested, surrounded by the flowers on the wall and the plastic tick of the clock, dosing the moments one by one. The coroner showed up in a white van with a raised roof and pulled out a gurney. He was large and fit for his age, late 50s, and nearly bald. He had a cigarette in his mouth, said he had to make sure the doorways and stairs were wide enough. Kit pointed him upstairs and stayed by the front door. She wasn't sure she wanted to see Eleanor again. When he came back down, two officers arrived wearing black, fleecy uniform coats. The older one had a coffee and chuffed white steam as he sipped. The younger took off his cowboy hat and black leather glove and reached out his hand. Kit recognized him as Caleb, the young man with the shy squint who had been so nice to her at the spaghetti supper. They had crossed paths in town on occasion. He would wave or tip his hat, but she always rushed on by. It didn't matter he was only a cop in training. She was uneasy about his getting a good look at her. Today, though, she had called the police herself. She didn't know what was supposed to happen with the body, but she was at least clear-headed enough to know that not calling the police would look shady. She hadn't expected Caleb. He looked so friendly, and she was so worn out from crying and carrying Eleanor and missing her, so worried about where she would go next, that she shook his hand and noticed a strange desire to be hugged by him. "Ha, Kit," he said. "I'm so sorry about Ms. Eleanor. Officer Jackson gave me a heads up he was coming to take her away and let me come along." The older cop nodded to Kit, then went upstairs with the coroner. Caleb stayed downstairs. "How are you doing?" he asked, real sweet, like he genuinely wanted to know. She shook her head and felt too sad to answer. He smiled in an understanding way. "It couldn't have been easy on you, finding her there. I was the one who found my daddy." Kit remembered Eleanor mentioning his father had died. She kept her eyes on him to show she was listening. "I don't know if you want to hear about this."
"I do," Kit said. She was glad for a distraction from her grief.
"He fell in the shower," Caleb said. "I heard the sound. He was a big man, and the weight of him coming down on the bathtub, well, I don't have to tell you the rest, but it was something awful."
Kit nodded. "Something so awful you couldn't feel it," she said.
"Exactly," he said, and he lit up. "Like I was watching it on a screen. Like I wasn't really a part of it."
There was a pause between them. Kit was comforted to hear him put words to a feeling she had had so many times before.
"Was he a good dad then?" Kit asked.
Caleb let out an uneasy chuckle.
"Nah," he said. "He was a son of a bitch."
Kit smiled. She had such a peculiar feeling talking to Caleb. At first, she thought there wasn't much to him. Just a nice, simple, white bread kind of guy. But he was also very steady and reassuring, more than she would expect to look at him. And he had been through hard times, too. The stairs inside groaned under heavy, cautious steps as the men brought down the gurney. When they got to the bottom of the stairs, the coroner released a latch and extended the gurney's wheeled legs. He handed Kit a clipboard with some paperwork and a pen.
"Here's where you release the remains to me," he said, gruff and detached. "You read it through and sign anywhere you see an X. You can say your goodbyes now."
He unzipped the body bag just past Eleanor's face. He pulled out another cigarette, offered one to Officer Jackson, and went back to the van to smoke it. Caleb stepped away to allow Kit a moment with Eleanor. Kit pulled the sides of the body bag open to get a better look at her aunt. Even in the half hour since Kit had last seen Eleanor's body, it had changed. Her spirit was gone. Her eyelids were sunken,
and her skin had lost the last of its color. There was nothing of her personality left, only the traces of the life she had lived. Kit stroked Eleanor's fine, long hair to feel her again. And still, nothing. It was a hollow goodbye. She wished she could go back to the night before, when Eleanor, in her long, blue flannel nightgown, had poked her head in Kit's room and told her to
take out the damn garbage and tie the bag tidy-tight or the mice will be here to stay.
Then, she had shuffled in her two big house slippers and dropped a loud fart and laughed at herself all the way back down the stairs. The sleepy cemetery director allowed it. One less digger to pay. Though not without chiding her for the late stage of her pregnancy. It was the very least she could do for Eleanor. The orange clay soil was dense and unyielding, and Kit took plenty of breaks to let the little one rest. But her palms were full of blisters by the time the work was done. Perhaps it was better, she reasoned as she cleaved the earth with her shovel, that Eleanor never knew how wicked she had been. Her aunt had died in peace, she hoped, among family, with the happy promise of a new baby. Wasn't that a good thing? A great many people showed up, some tearful, some not. Pastor Tom spoke a few words and called her Ellie when he said goodbye. Caleb was there and cried when Beulah went up and sang, "I'll Fly Away." Her child's voice, which sounded so silly when she spoke, was angelic in song. The service was simple and elegant, the only hiccup being that Sugar Fay, whose pregnancy was on display in a revealing black dress, wept and snorted and blew her nose in a conspicuous show of grief, her sons in the near distance playing tackle tag among the gravestones. Kit thought Eleanor would have gotten a kick out of it. When the service was over, Kit took up her shovel and covered the coffin with dirt. Each time she dug her shovel in, her chest tightened, her throat twisted like someone was wringing it. Her hands began to shake, and she rested on a knee to gather strength and calm the gale that was stirred up inside her. There was no time to grieve. Her belly was large and heavy in her hips, and the feeling that she had to pee just never went away. She had to find a place to live before she was due. Baby would not bide. Now that her only connection to this place was gone, Kit couldn't see any use in staying. 6 months in Pecan Hollow, and she was still an outsider. She could feel the stares and whispers at her back whenever she went to town. And the longer she stayed, the more she'd craved the feeling of a fresh start. About $150 was all the money she'd saved, but it was enough to buy a bus ticket and get a cheap room while she looked for work. It wouldn't last long, but there was surely something for her in Houston. Yard work. Cleaning. She was so deep in thought, she hadn't noticed the man standing behind her. When he said hello, she nearly took his head off with the shovel. The booze-bloated man in a dated blazer with wide lapels held a hand to his neck and took a long step backward, cleared his throat.
C. Lewis Vaughn, Esquire, Miss Walker. I was your aunt's attorney.
She leaned on the shovel's handle and let him continue while she waited for her hackles to go down.
I'm sorry to catch you at a sensitive time, but your aunt requested her final wishes be delivered to you.
He smiled tightly, showing teeth with coffee stains of deep amber. Now? She said, feeling cornered.
No time like the present.
He sat down on a nearby bench and patted the seat next to him. Kit approached, but remained standing. When he took off his hat, there was a band of sweat around his head. Stray hairs glued in curls at his temples. He straightened his bolo tie and read aloud. This was the first time she had thought about Eleanor's will, or anyone else's for that matter. It felt strange to be included in such an official event.
The last will and testament of Eleanor, prepared by yours truly, etc., etc. Okay, here we go.
To my lost and found niece, Kit Walker, in the unlikely event of my death. As I write, I am, apart from my little heart thingy, enjoying robust and vigorous health. I have no plans to die, nor have I reckoned myself to this possibility. However, should nature overpower me, the following are my sincerest wishes. I leave the whole of my estate, the specifics of which are listed below, to you, Kit. This is not merely a formality for next of kin, but an expression of my love and affection. It is not much, but will ensure you and your child will always have a home.
A home. Kit walked away, bracing against a heavy emotion. She leaned her head on a tree trunk and felt the bark press into her forehead and belly. She had been so ready to leave and start over. Now, this unimaginable gift. If this was real, how could she leave? How could she stay without Eleanor? Kit tried to tell herself Eleanor had wanted this for her. Somewhere in her great, broken heart, she'd made room for Kit and the baby to be. It was difficult for Kit to let herself feel how much she might have wanted to stay. Inches from her face, a cicada husk, lifelike and paper thin, clung to the bark. When she tried to blow it off, it quivered, but did not let go.
"Miss Walker, if you don't mind," the lawyer said.
He looked impatient and barreled ahead with the specifics of Eleanor's estate. These included title to the house and everything in it, the truck, and enough savings to cover the remaining house payments for 6 months or so.
"Please forgive the pesky note on the house. My payments are small, but you'll need a job soon to keep them current. I know you'll figure it out."
It was too much. She did not deserve it. She needed time to think this over. Vaughn shook the papers at her and tapped them with a pen to indicate he needed a signature. She hated him for witnessing this moment, so dear to her, so trivial to him. She wiped her tears on the gray wool sleeve of a coat she'd taken from Eleanor. He looked at her with unveiled suspicion.
"Well, I can't say I haven't seen it before. Long-lost relatives coming in to butter up old family members."
Kit narrowed her eyes at him. "What's that supposed to mean?"
"It is strange, though, isn't it? Nothing to prove you're really family. Nothing to go on but your word."
He picked his teeth graphically with the cap of his pen.
"Ellie told me she didn't know a thing about your background and that she wasn't going to push the issue. Heart of gold, that woman. Worked out pretty nice for you there, don't you think?"
Kit was suddenly hot.
"Listen, man, I've got a baby coming and I just buried the only family I've got. You think I wanted this to happen?"
His hands went up in self-defense.
"Hey, look, people are talking. It's not just me. You show up, take over her house. Few months later, she's out of the way. You'd be a fool if you didn't see it."
She wished she could knock this turd of a man into a hole and bury him alive. How could they think she had wanted her aunt dead when Eleanor was the only good thing in her life right now? And not just him. Apparently, people were talking. No way in hell could she stay if people suspected her of hurting Eleanor.
It's always the old sick ones with the long-lost relatives. The lonely ones, ain't it?
Kit stuck her head out. She would not let this smarmy beetle of a man cut her down.
"You're a sorry piece of shit for talking to me like that," she said. "Eleanor was a good woman, and she would fire your ass for coming over here on the day of her funeral, making it seem like I wanted this, any of this."
Vaughn was unperturbed.
"Well,"
he fluttered the papers at her. Kit didn't even know what day it was. How could she be expected to make this decision right now? She wanted to cry for how much she wished Eleanor were here. She didn't know how to act right or fall in line. She had gotten used to having an ally and had enjoyed her aunt's protection from the people in town. But whatever doubt she had had about Eleanor's intentions, that she was acting out of guilt, Kit knew now that her aunt had wanted her to stay. That her aunt knew Kit's child deserved an address and a mailbox and chickens to tend. Deserved to go to school and make friends and have neighbors that knew her since she was yay high. Deserved to wake up in the same house every morning with enough to eat and with pictures of her goddamn family on the wall. Eleanor was right. This baby deserved everything Kit never had. Kit was through with running away. She grabbed the papers and pen from the lawyer and began to sign.
"Well, congratulations, Ms. Walker."
He chuckled and tucked the will away in his breast pocket.
"You done very good for yourself. I expect you'll be putting the house up for sale, cashing in and going on your way."
Not that she owed him an answer, but she felt like putting it on the record.
"No, sir. I'll be staying here in Pecan Hollow."
Part 3. Chapter 21. Pecan Hollow, Texas, 1990. When Kit awoke, she lay face up in the grass, interlacing branches of mature pecans above her. She rested there in a daze, at first not sure where she was, letting the pieces fall slowly together. Muddled memories returned to her, less pungent than before. Pork chops and biscuits and Eleanor humming while she cooked. Hard, cold dirt and blisters on her hands. The echo of her voice in an empty house. A fresh spring of grief bubbled up, and she wished she could see Eleanor one more time, wrap her arms around the dough of her back, and see the easy benevolence in her gaze. Eat one perfect meal at her table, and ask every question she'd never gotten to ask about her mother. Then the thought of Manny at her door, and with it, more memories. Loud sanitary paper and iodine, a scalpel in the shoulder, barbecue smoke, gun smoke, baby Ray's cries, the hateful look on Manny's face as he lunged against the men who held him. Her heartbeat quickened. She had been terrified that day, scared enough to leave her partner, her whole life behind. She had been certain that the hate she saw would not pass. It was enough to keep her from looking back. In the time since she left, she had strived to move on and convinced herself she'd succeeded. And with Charlie born so soon after, there wasn't much room to wallow. There was too much heartache in the looking back, so she had trained her sights on the many demands of now. Keeping Charlie fed and clothed, fixing leaks, patching plaster, minding the hens. She had made a certain peace with being alone. She'd been born that way, after all. But now, having seen him, tenderized somehow and almost sweet, she wished she could see him again. She could smell him in her pores her hair, the tang of his sweat and spit on her tongue. The throb of wanting him lingered. She found it impossible to untangle the good feelings from the bad. Fright from affection, cunning from caring, loathing from attraction. What Kit couldn't understand was why, after all he had done, his touch still rippled through her. Against all her good sense, she wanted him back like a severed hand. An old worry, felt anew, that she might never feel whole without him. She was ashamed at the thought of how much she had needed Manny, that her need had almost killed her. Like an infant, she had been glued to him, desperate when he dropped out of sight. It felt like a betrayal now, thinking of how she had loved Manny when her whole heart should belong to Charlie. Poor Charlie. How nasty Kit had been to her. She wished she hadn't pushed her down or made her feel like she'd done something wrong. Something in her had burst when her two worlds overlapped. She had lashed out at her daughter, but she was only scared. Scared of the Manny she had left behind. She pushed herself up stiffly. The chickens had retreated to their hutch for the night, but she could hear them clucking. A smudge of moon behind a passing cloud. A line of white egrets nestled on the fence. Something tickled her left leg, and she looked down. In the glow of the front porch light, thousands of ants covered a deep oozing gash on her shin. She hopped up, staggered to the hose, and turned it on her leg. The spray blasted the wound clean and started a fresh bleed, red ribbons trailing down with the gush of water. With the ants and blood flushed out, she could see the depth of the wound. About 4 inches long, it cut through some of the meat on the outside of her shin and nicked the bone. When she bore weight on it, she could see the bare muscle contract and bleed. If she didn't clean and suture it soon, there might be permanent damage. "God damn it," she said aloud, and realized she must have hacked her leg while she was raging on the brambles. She went inside to mend herself. The house was quiet but for the creaks and sounds of Kit limping across the floor. She stopped to listen for Charlie, but heard nothing. She mounted the stairs, using the rail to bear her weight, and peeked in Charlie's room. Books, pencils, and garbage littered the floor. Her desk was overturned and her chair broken on its side. Kit could hardly blame her. The sheets, which had been peeled back, sat in a pile at the foot of the bed. On the bare mattress, Charlie lay, knees to chest, staring at her mother shamelessly. Too tired to begin to address the state of the room, or the fight that had inspired it, Kit just sighed. Charlie noticed the bloody leg and lifted her head. "It's fine," Kit said. "I'm about to fix it up." She turned and hopped to the bathroom. Where others might feel a sickening sting, Kit only felt thumping. She pulled out the tin tackle box filled with baggies of gauze, a bottle of alcohol, ointment, bandages, and a pint of bourbon for nerves. She sat on the edge of the tub and laid out her supplies. The leg throbbed. Viscous blood covered the slit of bone. Kit doused the wound, the tools, and her hands in alcohol, then threaded a hooked needle she had pinched from Doc's supplies. She took a nip of bourbon and a deep breath. The door opened and Charlie peered in, a swish of black hair and worried eyes. "You might as well help me," Kit said, and Charlie sat down beside her. Kit took the alcohol and disinfected Charlie's hands, too. "Here," Kit said, pushing the sides of the gash closed to form a neat line. Hold this steady while I stitch. Charlie did as she was told, wincing when Kit first pierced the skin. When she was finished suturing, Charlie wrapped the leg in thick, clean gauze. Together, they scrubbed the bathroom and wiped away the blood Kit had tracked up the stairs. After the grisly excitement of their evening, they recessed to the living room and Charlie turned on the TV. A cooling breeze passed through the transom windows. Kit propped her bum leg on a chair and lowered herself next to Charlie on the sagging floral sofa Aunt Eleanor had bought a half a century ago. Sitting there in the dark room, Charlie breathing hotly by her side, Kit looked at her daughter, half his, and knew she should tell her something about this man who had appeared out of thin air. She owed it to her. But to reveal the truth about Manny would be to incriminate herself. One question would lead to another, and the whole mess would be laid bare, hideous in the light. How could she explain choosing to live with a man she didn't know, helping him rip people off and living on money that wasn't theirs? The thought of explaining to Charlie where she came from and why Charlie had never met her father brought up a shame that Kit could not stomach. She pulled her girl closer to her and squeezed so hard, Charlie shrugged her off. Kit didn't know why Manny had come or how long he would stay. Maybe he was changed. Maybe he came in peace. She didn't know how to sort through the mystery of her feelings for him. But there was a warning in the instinct that had overwhelmed her at the sight of him, to protect Charlie. And that's what she resolved to do.